Hello everyone, welcome to JTalk Extra Time. All of the latest J2 news is coming up. I'm John Steele, hosting this week, and I'm joined to help me to get through another pretty exciting round of action by James Taylor. James, how are you doing?
All right, John, how are you?
Yeah, very good, thanks. I should say, James, thank you for agreeing to come on quite late at night, and it's getting quite close to both of our bedtimes as usual, so I appreciate that. Thanks.
You're welcome. Yeah, it's actually past my bedtime, but don't worry about it.
Oh, good. That's, okay. Well, suitably guilted. We should carry on. Yeah. And I will as well just say a quick thanks to Stuart Smith, who did a pretty stellar job with a solo J2 pod for JTET last week. And he was a little bit under the weather last week and very busy at work. So, Stu, if you're out there and you're listening, thanks for helping out last week. It's much appreciated. James, I think we better get straight into it with J2. It was round 34 last weekend, so we're only eight games to go. Things are getting pretty exciting. The only place we can start is with the relegation zone. I think that's where all the action is. So we'll talk about the teams from the bottom up to start with. So Sagamihara are on the bottom of the table at the moment. They lost 1-0 at home to Yamagata in round 34. Pretty good match, this one, with chances at both ends, especially in the first half. The winning goal came on the stroke of half time from Hikaru Nakahara, who played a lovely 1-2 with Vinicius Araujo. A brilliant return pass from him, and then Nakahara confidently beat the Sagamihara goalkeeper. The home side's big chance came right at the end when Shunto Kodama hit the crossbar, so Sagamihara close to getting a point. But I think Yamagata were the better side, and it finished Sagamihara 0, Yamagata 1. The second bottom team, Matsumoto, were very easily beaten, weren't they, James? 3-0 away at Okayama, with Satoki Uejo scoring twice for the home side. Uejo had already had a goal disallowed for offside, very harshly it seemed, in my view. But then he did put Okayama ahead for real, if you like, in the 13th minute. He cruised past Matsumoto's backline and the goalkeeper after a through ball from Hideki Ishige. And it was Ishige who scored Okayama's second in the 63rd minute, firing in from outside the box from Shuhei Tokumoto's pass. The ball deflected off the head of Matsumoto defender Masato Tokida and then went in off the underside of the crossbar. So I think Matsumoto must have sensed it wasn't their day when that goal went in. 4 minutes from full time, Uejo scored again with an absolute missile from about 25 yards to make it 3-0. It was almost a shame that he wasted such a good goal on a game that was already won, because I think this is a real goal of the season contender for me. But I guess it might be forgotten, might get lost in the shuffle, because Okayama were already 3-0 up. And yet, James, before I come to you, we had a couple of quick questions on Matsumoto, because it's starting to look like they are in very real trouble. Gabriele Agnello asks, is he the only person incapable of getting his head around the idea of a Yamaga versus Nagano Parseiro derby in J3 next year? Matsumoto going down seemed impossible at the start of the season. And then Magic Mike Innes, never heard of him, obviously. He asks, is there any evidence that Matsumoto can avoid relegation? So you mentioned that you watched this game in full, James. Okayama 3, Matsumoto 0. What did you think? And any thoughts on Sagamihara losing at home to Yamagata?
Where to start with Matsumoto? They're a mess, aren't they? I think Gabriele's question is interesting, because it's almost inconceivable that Matsumoto would go down to J3. They were in J1 2 years ago. It's crazy how far they've fallen. And it just, like, they're a shambles on the pitch. I watched, as you say, I watched this game in full. I've watched a lot of Matsumoto games, actually, because I tend to choose games where there are lots of goals. And Matsumoto have conceded the most goals in J2. So they get pumped pretty much every week. And they played in this, it's not the first time, but I was watching this and I couldn't discern any game plan. Couldn't figure out what they were trying to do. You know, other teams, even like Kanazawa, they're not very good and the plan doesn't work, but you can see what the plan is and what the players are trying to do. But with Matsumoto, I couldn't figure out what they were trying to do. They played like a bunch of blokes who'd responded to an advert on Facebook saying, we need players, can you show up at the Sun Pro Alwyn at 1:30, bring your boots, you'll get a game, kind of thing. I'd never met before. It's just crazy what they're doing. And so if for them to go down to J3, it would be pretty massive, but it would also mean that we have potentially an interesting J3 next year. If Matsumoto and if Kanazawa went down as well, you got the Shinshu Derby, Matsumoto Nagano. You'd have the Hokushinetsu Derby of Matsumoto Kanazawa. You'd have a Hokuriku Derby of Kanazawa Toyama. I assume that's what they call it. I don't think it's ever been played before. And then you'd have the what they tried to brand as the Hakusan Derby with Kanazawa and Gifu. So that would be pretty interesting. Obviously, I don't want Kanazawa to go down, and I don't care what happens to Matsumoto. But as for Mike's question, can they stay up? It is possible that Matsumoto can stay up, but only because everything is so congested at the bottom of the table. But they, like all the other teams down there, they're running out of games and they don't seem to know what to do. They're a mess. And it wouldn't surprise me if they went down. Actually, thinking about it, back at the start, in the preview pods, back at the start of the season, I think it was Mike who said Matsumoto's recruitment was, it looked dodgy. They just signed a load of players. And obviously it hasn't worked. And then partway through the season, they signed Serginho and seemed like they were just going to pin all their hopes on him because the other 35 players weren't good enough. But then he's injured. So now they're back to just kind of rambling aimlessly around the pitch. That being said, I think Okuyama were really good. And they're on a pretty decent run at the moment, and Uejo was fantastic. It's interesting that you thought that the offside was harsh, because I thought it was offside, but the angle of the camera was pretty hard to tell, really. But yeah, that his second goal, the Okuyama's third goal, that was fantastic. And it's interesting because Okuyama have got the joint best defense in the league. But they've got the third fewest goals scored. So I think Uejo, I was reading, it was on the J League Register website. So Uejo seems like he's on the way up, and I wouldn't be surprised if he moves maybe to a J2 promotion challenger or to a J1 team for next year. If Okuyama can keep him, as they promised Mitch Duke they were going to get a squad worthy of pushing for promotion, then they might be able to challenge. Although, as people have been saying, it's not a good idea to bet on Okuyama to finally get their act together and actually challenge. But they were good value for that win. Most teams are good value for their win against Matsumoto, because Matsumoto are just terrible. Sorry to any Matsumoto supporters listening, but I mean, they probably already know that.
I think they've turned it off already. I think they've turned it off already, James.
Maybe you should edit this and move it to the end of the pod. For the Sagamihara Yamagata match, I guess this is kind of back to normal for Sagamihara after that madness against Mito a couple of weeks ago. But I didn't really see much of Sagamihara in the first half of the season. I just never really got around to watching any of their games. But I've seen a bit more of them recently. And it seems like their results don't really tell the whole story. Because I know they brought in a lot of, after they changed the manager, they brought in a lot of players partway through the season. And it seems like they're attacking much more than I had imagined. And possibly much more than they actually were earlier in the season. But yeah, they had one big defensive lapse, which cost them here. They were just carved open down the middle, weren't they? As for Yamagata, they're just ruining their poor start, aren't they? And if they can keep their squad together for next year, then with that manager, I think they'll do really well. But that's a big if, isn't it? Because teams tend to get gutted in the off season.
Yeah, well, I think we have a question about that coming up a little bit later. So there is a tease for later on in the pod. If any Matsumoto fans are still listening, but yeah, I think with Sagamihara, you're right to point out it's a kind of Jekyll and Hyde situation from the first half of the season to the second, and I think they probably have a weaker squad than Matsumoto if we compare them directly. But Sagamihara have a much better manager in the form of Takuya Takagi, I think. So you have a kind of weaker squad with a good manager, and Matsumoto have the stronger squad. But yeah, they're playing terrible football. The word that sprang to my mind watching, I actually watched just the first kind of 20 or 25 minutes of the game against Okayama. They were just absolutely clueless. They were hopeless. And I don't really think they wanted to battle, and I don't think they wanted to play. I'm not really sure what they were trying to do in that first 25 minutes, but after 5 minutes, I said to my son, I was watching the game with him, Okayama are going to score in a minute. And then they did score, but it was disallowed with the Ueda's offside goal. But I said, don't worry, they'll have another one before too long. And I think it was about 20, but it was about 20 seconds, it seemed like. And then Ueda did score. And I think Okayama are a good mid-table J2 side. But Matsumoto made them look like Brazil, sort of, you know, 1982. And a better team would have sent Matsumoto for 7 or 8 goals just in that first half, I think. They were so bad. So, yeah, Mike and Gabriele, yes, and Nagano are definitely staying in J3 for next year. So, yeah, Matsumoto could well be joining them. And, yeah, based on the performances, I don't see any hope of them getting out of it. I think they have it good enough players, but they just need to get their act together. Whether they can do that remains to be seen. Sagamihara, I'd give them a puncher's chance because, like you said, they're so improved in terms of what they do when they go forward under Takagi. But yeah, they don't score enough goals. I accept that they just had 4 against Mito, but that was the exception and not the rule. So James, this is a theme on the pod that we're running out of matches, but nothing's becoming much clearer at the bottom. But yeah. So I think we're still as where we were with Sagamihara. They've got a puncher's chance. And Matsumoto, we're just kind of waiting with bated breath for them to just get their act together, and they just don't seem to be able to do it. But yeah, we'll have to wait and see. We'll perhaps have this conversation again in a month or so and see where we are. We'll move on, James, if that's all right. Usually I give you the games 2 at a time, but there was one which had so much incident at the end. I think we better take it in isolation. This is the third bottom team, Kitakyushu. They thought they'd snatched a late victory at home to Tokyo Verdy, but then they conceded a 97th minute equaliser to draw 2-2. Kitakyushu had a great chance in the 20th minute here when Sho Sato hit the post. Verdy were very lucky that the rebound came straight back to their goalkeeper, Takahiro Shibasaki. And then it was Verdy who took the lead with the help of the woodwork. 9 minutes into the second half, Yuhei Sato took aim from about 25 yards. The Kitakyushu keeper, Kenshin Yoshimaru, was able to palm his shot onto the bar, but the ball fell perfectly on the goal line for Ryoga Sato to tap in. Too many Satos in this game for my liking, James. And then there was referee drama in the last 15 minutes. Junichi Kabasawa, the referee, injured himself jumping over a ball and couldn't continue. Looked like he had a knee problem. He had to go off injured, and the fourth official, Akihiro Kamigawa, took over as the ref, which led to the 7 minutes of injury time, and more about that later. Kitakyushu then constructed a superb equaliser in the 86th minute. A great pass in behind the defence from Taiga Maekawa allowed So Fujitani to cross from the byline on the Kitakyushu right, and Takamitsu Tomiyama was on hand to head into an open goal because Verdy's goalkeeper Shibasaki was committed to collecting the cross. And then in the first minute of stoppage time, Kitakyushu actually went in front. A corner caused chaos in Verdy's penalty area. I wish I had a pound for every time I've said that this season, James. And Maekawa eventually poked the ball home in a goalmouth scramble from about 1 yard out. So at Kitakyushu 2 on up in stoppage time, But there was one more incredible twist. In the 97th minute, Ryoga Sato struck again. He collected a pass from Mizuki Arai and then span to fire the ball in from around about the penalty spot. This is despite Akita Kyushu defender being back on the line. The ball ended up in the back of the net. So an incredible finish to the match. Akita Kyushu 2, Tokyo Verde 2. An absolutely shattering late goal to concede for Akita Kyushu. James, but I think that's something we've said a few times this season. What did you make of this one?
Yeah, this was, like you said, pretty dramatic at the end. I watched this one in full, the referee, that looked pretty painful. He jarred his knee trying to jump out of the way of the ball. And that was actually the third time in the match he got in the way. Twice earlier, the ball actually bounced off him. So he finally managed to try and get out of the way and did his knee. So that was unfortunate for him, and I hope it's not as bad as it looked, because it looked like he was in a lot of pain going off. Yeah, the early on, I thought this was all Verdi early on, but they weren't doing anything with their possession. Like leading up to the drinks break in the first half, they'd had 71. I saw the stat: 71% of the ball, but no shots on target. But then when they did take the lead, it was after Akita Kyushu had finally managed to get into the game and have a bit of sustained pressure. So it was a bit of a sucker punch, I suppose, which they did again later, in stoppage time, as you just explained. And like you were saying, I think to take the lead in the 91st minute and then to concede an equaliser in the 96th could be a really big, confidence blow for Akita Kyushu, and also two dropped points could also be extremely important in the really tight relegation battle. But on the other hand, the fact that they managed to get a point, having gone behind originally and having barely been in the game for the first half, could, I mean, if they forget about the ending, they could take that as a positive and a confidence boost. Thinking about Akita Kyushu, they're another team that have really suffered for losing a lot of players from last season, and they look really slow going forward. I know it was really wet on Saturday, and so maybe the pitch had some kind of effect, but they just looked much less dynamic than they were last year, and that's probably down to the personnel. But they were better in the second half than they were in the first, but yeah, that late equaliser could be a killer.
Yeah, I think that there are parallels with Sagamihara's game against Yamagata for me, in the sense that, you know, Sagamihara played okay against Yamagata and lost, so they got no points, but there are some positives to take. And I think it's kind of the same with Akita Kyushu, isn't it? They got one point from that match, but it must have felt like a defeat because the equaliser from Verdi came so late. But on the other hand, yeah, they were able to score two pretty good goals from their point of view, and they're still alive and kicking. At the bottom, you know, it's not done yet. I think from the three teams we've discussed in relegation trouble so far, Matsumoto are the ones where I'm really reaching. I can't think of any positives from their situation. But I think yeah, if you're a Sagamihara supporter or a Akita Kyushu fan, I mean, yeah, you're probably not feeling great about things when you look at the league table. But there is hope, you know, that there is reasons for optimism. Speaking of optimism, James, there was a fantastic win for Ehime. They managed to pick up a 1-0 win away at FC Ryukyu. It's a result that moves Ehime up to 19th place in the table. So they're on the very edge of the relegation zone now. It was their veteran midfielder, Koji Yamase, who scored the vital goal just 3 minutes before full time. When a Ryukyu cross was cleared to him, inside his own half, he set up a counter-attack by passing to Yoshiki Fujimoto, and then when Fujimoto carried the ball into the penalty area, his low cross was swept in by Yamase from the edge of the six-yard box. So I don't think this was a classic game by any stretch of the imagination, although I thought the kits on show were classic and very J-League, James. You know, Ryukyu wearing this special kind of light blue kit and Ehime's orange with the kind of tiger sleeves is very J League look, isn't it? But yeah, it finished Ryukyu 0, Ehime 1. And breaking news, I delayed the pod because I was busy at work, but luckily we were in time for the news that this was the last game for Ryukyu's boss Yasuhiro Higuchi. James, he was fired this morning, Wednesday morning, and the head coach Tetsuhiro Kina is the new Ryukyu boss for the moment. So the relegation zone from the bottom to the top sounds like this. It's Sagamihara bottom on 29 points, then Matsumoto on 31, Kita Kyushu on 31, and Ehime with that important win on 32 points. And before I come to you for a comment, James, it's at Kanazawa Dreaming on Twitter, isn't it? So we should mention Kanazawa. They're level on points with Ehime in 18th place, and Kanazawa lost 2-1 at home to an in-form Kofu side in round 34. In this match, Kofu started extremely well. Kanazawa's keeper Masaaki Goto had to make good saves in the first half. The opening goal came from a swift break in the 37th minute. William Lira's nice backheel set Motoki Hasegawa away down the Kofu left. Now, his shot was kind of half-blocked by Taiki Watanabe, but the ball ran loose to Ryotaro Nakamura, who kind of had an easy tap-in as a result. So kind of an unfortunate goal for Kanazawa to concede, I feel. Hayato Otani, who was impressive again for Kanazawa, forced a decent save from Kohei Kawata in the Kofu goal. That was early in the second half. But the killer second goal for Kofu came just after the hour when a passing move on the edge of the Kanazawa box led to Hidehiro Sugai scoring with a low shot in off the post. A first J-League goal for him, I think. Kanazawa pulled a goal back with about 12 minutes to go. A thumping header from Honoya Shoji. I believe that's his third headed goal from a corner this season, so pretty good return from him. But Kanazawa couldn't find an equaliser in there. Yeah, it finished Kanazawa 1, Kofu 2. Three straight wins for Kofu, by the way, James. So they're up to third place in the table, but 8 points behind the second place team, Kyoto. It still looks like a tall order to catch them. But we can talk about the top of the table later on. James, Ryukyu 0, Ehime 1. Kanazawa 1, Kofu 2. What did you think?
So I start with the Ryukyu Ehime game. I watched the highlights of this one. I did it on Monday night, so all my notes are now out of date. there was a great result for Ehime. They've really struggled to get out of the bottom four, even when they've been getting good results. But they do still have hope because they're only in there on goal difference. And if they can keep putting these kind of occasional wins and together, then they might be okay. I thought it was pretty cool that Koji Yamase has now scored in 22 consecutive seasons, which is a really impressive achievement, and it's also a testament to older players who actually want to play in matches rather than just train and sit on the bench like some more famous people do. Ryukyu, thinking about this game in particular, I they had chances, it seemed, but they all looked kind of a bit half-hearted. And I don't know if that's because the players had nothing really to play for except contracts. But having had such a great start to the season, and now looking like they could finish as low as 11th, it's really disappointing. And this is their third year in J2, and it's the third year where they've started really well and then fallen away. Maybe last year they didn't start brilliantly, but they did fall away a lot. The year before that, they started really, really well and then ended up mid-table, I think. And also, I kind of feel a bit sorry for the supporters because they weren't able to go to any games for a long time because of the state of emergency. And since they've finally been able to get back into the stadium, they've seen some absolute dross from Ryukyu. But and I was going to ask you, actually, I have written down in my notes, what does John think about the likelihood of a manager change in the winter? But, I mean, that question might still be valid because I guess the Kina is maybe he's auditioning for it. But with Higuchi it seemed like there was a bit of sort of anti-Higuchi sentiment bubbling up. But he stated the goal was 80 points for this year, and they're not going to get anywhere near that, really. Second half of the season has been dismal. I know they've had injuries, but they get injuries every year. So maybe that's something to do with the training methods, which is his responsibility, isn't it? But yeah, sacking with 8 games left, I thought maybe it's slightly strange timing, but then I mean, think about it. They don't have anything. They're not in danger of relegation, but they're not pushing for promotion. So now's a good chance for someone else to take over and have a go and then see if they can get it permanently. But yeah, I mean, it's a shame for Higuchi because he has established Ryukyu as a solid J2 side over the last almost 3 years. So I think overall he's done a good job, but I guess not good enough. So instead of asking you with the likelihood of a manager change, I would like to ask you what you think Ryukyu will do next and what Higuchi will do next.
Yeah, I think these are good questions. I was hoping you're going to stick with the manager change one because I had a good answer. I was just going to read out a press release to answer that one. I still think the timing is a little bit strange because these things tend to happen at the end of the season, during the winter break and not before. I mean, they could have announced that he was... They could have announced today that he was going to leave at the end of the season, for example. So sacking him kind of, immediately seems a little bit strange to me. I get the feeling, reading between the lines, maybe the relationship between Higuchi and perhaps the front office is not good at this point. That might explain why his dismissal's coming right now rather than at the end of the season. I don't have any inside information. It's just the way it looks to me. And I think you make a good point that at the moment it's Tetsuhiro Kina in charge. The press release that I read today didn't mention anything about him being a kind of interim or caretaker, but that's definitely kind of feels like that. He's going to take charge for these last 8 games, and then maybe if they win 6 and draw 1, he'll get the job for next season. But I don't think that's very likely. I think they'll look for somebody. Higher profile than someone who I had to Google and I'd never heard of. For Higuchi, it's an interesting shout, isn't it? You would think quite a few J2 teams are going to be in the market for a new manager, next season, and he might be fielding phone calls from several. Of course, he's managed in J1 as well. Right, at Yokohama Marinos, so he does have some pedigree at the higher level, so I think he could go. There are quite a few places where he could end up. I don't expect to see him in J3, where I know he was YSCC manager for a little while. But where he could go is anybody's guess. Yeah, but yeah, as for Ryukyu, yeah, I don't know. I think the first half of the season promised so much. Didn't it? And then it's kind of fallen. It's all fallen a little bit flat. But I still think the kind of from what I read on Twitter today, I kind of agree with it. It's a bit harsh considering. Was it they finished 16th last year, 15th or 16th?
Something like that.
So that they're obviously on course for a massive improvement on last season. We had a similar discussion about Sagamihara firing their manager when they were looking like they were going to get cut adrift at the bottom. But it turned out the people running the club knew more than we did on that occasion. So it remains to be seen if it's the same here. But I do think it's... I don't think clubs necessarily owe managers anything. So it's perhaps wrong to describe it as being ungrateful to fire Higuchi at this point. That's not right because they pay his wages and I'm sure they're going to pay him off quite handsomely. It does seem a bit unnecessarily. It's like an aggressive firing, I think, that seems a bit unnecessary. What was the question, James? I'm rambling.
No, you've answered it pretty well. I mean, what are they going to do next? I mean, we don't know, do we? And what's he going to do next? We don't know either. But yeah, I agree. Part of me felt it was strange, and part of me thought it was a bit. It was maybe a good time, but it is. I mean, 8 games left is a strange. I'm rambling as well. Should we talk about Kanazawa? Oh, we've got to talk about Kanazawa.
Let's talk. I think there's an elephant in the room we should probably address. Yeah. What about Kanazawa?
Yeah, I was trying to. No, this. I watched this game in full, and it was pretty dull, to be honest. What you saw in the DAZN highlights was pretty much. I mean, obviously, with the highlights, but there was nothing else really particularly interesting about the game. From my perspective, which is obviously one of Kanazawa bias and probably sour grapes, Kofu's goals were avoidable. The first one, you're right, there was some really nice passing in that build-up, but it was from a Kanazawa throw down by Kofu corner flag, and they managed to get the ball and just go all the way up. And there was a bit of luck with that half block from Watanabe, but... The second goal, they went the length of the pitch again, but it should have been stopped. And the other thing with the second goal, you mentioned the keeper made a killer save from Otani, but what the highlights did not show was that was not given as a corner, it was given as a goal kick. And from that goal kick, Kofu went down the pitch and scored. But bearing in mind, I saw this statistic that Kofu's goals against, more than half of their goals against, are from set pieces. So they're worst in the league for conceding from set pieces. And most of Kanazawa's goals come from set pieces. And also bear in mind that later in that match, we did score from a corner. I think that was quite a big decision, a wrong decision. Although, having said that, we did get a corner shortly after we conceded the second goal, and the Kanazawa player on the edge of the area fell over, and Kofu went all the way up the other end of the pitch with the ball anyway. So perhaps it doesn't mean anything. But yeah, another really good emphatic header from Shoji. Yeah, you're right, that's his third this year, and they've all been pretty thumping. But yeah, I did figure out, I know a while back you were wondering whether Mendes, the Kofu defender, was good or not. And I think I tweeted you to say, I've been wondering the same. I think I figured it out. He's very tall and he's quite broad as well. And so he's really good at heading. He has to be because he's tall. If he's a tall person who's not good at heading, he wouldn't get a job. But he's also, he's really good at getting in the way. Obstruction, I think, is his other main skill. Shepherding the ball out of play. Because he's so big, people can't get around him.
Well, Mendes's body seems to have more right angles than most people somehow. Do you know what I mean? It's like a very angular frame.
Yeah. Now, he was at Kanazawa. I think he was at Kanazawa in 2016. And from what I remember, he was really lanky. So he bulked up a bit in the intervening years. And he is using that bulk to his team's benefit. So, yeah, good for him. I guess that's part of their plan. But yeah, overall, this game, it felt really similar to the game between these teams earlier in the season, which I think finished 2-0 to Kofu. Again, with two goals that I thought were a bit soft at the time. For Kanazawa, looking at the last eight fixtures, I think six of them are games against teams that, I mean, I don't want to say that they're winnable because we're a team that just went on a 13-game winless run, but they're teams that if we had any kind of confidence, we would be targeting those as things, games we can win. But you know, yeah, like that winless run was horrible. I mean, it's over now, thankfully. I'm really glad I was there to see that finish, but that felt at times, I said it on Twitter as well, it felt like one of those Stuart Lee routines where he just repeats the same line over again but changes a detail slightly. And it goes from being really, really funny to slightly funny to really annoying and then back to being funny again. And we were stuck in the really annoying and unfunny stage. And people might say, why are you repeating jokes that you've already made on, it's a joke, things you've already said on Twitter. But if Stuart Lee can keep telling jokes from the 90s, then I'm sure I can repeat something from a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, so... I don't know, Kanazawa, it's been a pretty terrible second half of the season for us as well, isn't it?
Yeah, to be honest, I mean, not that I'm anxious to draw too many parallels between the teams at the bottom, but I think it does help me to get things straight in my head. But I think this game is perhaps similar in some ways to Sagamihara losing at home to Yamagata, in that it's you would probably expect Sagamihara wouldn't have been expecting to get anything from that game, probably, and maybe Kanazawa the same, right? Home game against Kofu is going to be very tough. So losing that match doesn't really change the big picture. You said, you've got to go out in those games that you have left against sort of the more, should we call them, more winnable games, and go out and produce results in those. So it's a funny thing, James. You know, we get together and talk about the latest round, but I think the situation at the bottom is still very so fluid, isn't it? You know, a lot can happen in these last eight games. So. Fair enough. And I take your point about the corner. I think there are a few more dodgy refereeing decisions that we've got to discuss in part two. But let's take a quick recording break now, James. When we come back, the next section I've called the Still in Trouble Zone. So let's talk about that when we come back. Welcome back, everyone. James and I have had a quick break for refreshments, but James, we're not quite done with the relegation zone, or the still in trouble zone at the bottom of J2. So let's continue. Now, in 17th place in the table, a point ahead of Ehime and Kanazawa, are Yamaguchi, who ended a run of four straight defeats by drawing 2-2 at home to Mito. I say at home, but this game was played in Shimonoseki, not the usual Yamaguchi Stadium, which kind of caused me to do a double take when I was watching the highlights earlier. In this game, there was an early warning for Yamaguchi as Mito's Masato Nakayama headed against the bar from a free kick in just the third minute. Now, the warning wasn't heeded, James, because from an almost identical position and another free kick, Jefferson Tabinas headed Mito in front in the 12th minute. However, Yamaguchi were level just 3 minutes after that with a sumptuous 25-yard free kick from Georgi Ikegami, which went over the wall and right into Ayumi Niyakawa's bottom right-hand corner. Fantastic free kick from him. And there was controversy before the break. Yamaguchi's Kaito Kuwahara scored with a header that was disallowed for offside, but the replay showed pretty clearly that he wasn't offside and it was the wrong decision, so the teams went in level at 1-1 at the break. Yamaguchi did take the lead around the hour mark, though. This was a bullet header from Hennick at the back post from Wataru Tanaka's free kick, but we should never count Mito out, as Stuart Smith reminded us on Twitter, and they levelled through Shota Fujio about 15 minutes from full time. He escaped the attentions of Hennick and latched onto Mizuki Ando's through ball and then rifled the ball in off the far post. So this game finished Yamaguchi 2, Mito 2. Now, James, one place and one point ahead of Yamaguchi are Gunma in 16th, and they picked up a point from a 1-1 draw at home to Kyoto in round 34. In this game, Gunma actually took the lead just before half-time, thanks to Genki Omine. It was a pretty rare scene, wasn't it? A defensive cock-up from Kyoto. Their right back Takahiro Iida underhit a back pass. Omai chased it down. Kyoto's goalie Tomio Akahara, not the best candidate to deal with this situation. I don't think he got to the ball first, but Omai quite cleverly just waited for him to slide tackle nobody and then left Omai with an open goal, and he dutifully scored. It's not often that Kyoto can see goals in such comical circumstances. But Gunma 1-0 up at the break. The lead only lasted until the 50th minute, though. Peter Utaka scored his 18th goal of the season with a low drive from about 20 yards that arrowed into the bottom corner. I watched this goal a few times, James, and I just couldn't work out how Peter Utaka had found the angle to squeeze the ball in. But I guess that's why he's paid the big bucks and I'm not. But Kyoto had plenty of chances to win this one. Tenma Matsuda, probably with the best chance. He beat the Gunma keeper Keiki Shimizu, but Gunma defender Masaya Kojima brilliantly headed the ball off the line. And then it was Gunma who nearly won it right at the death. Tomoyuki Shiraishi hit Kyoto's crossbar with a snapshot from just inside the penalty area, but it finished Gunma 1, Kyoto 1. What did you think, James? And how about Yamaguchi 2, Mito 2 as well?
Yeah, well, Yamaguchi, I thought this was a bit of a missed opportunity for them to get a bit of breathing room between themselves and the relegation zone, but they'll be happy to end that losing streak. It was four games, which is pretty awful. But then, yeah, Mito, they're so much fun to watch as a neutral. I think I need to watch more full Mito matches, because I watched the highlights of this one and it was really good. They're really unpredictable and entertaining, and they're committed to attacking football and all the things that I like to watch. It was pretty good to see that was Jefferson Tabernas' first career goal, I think, actually. So it was a nice moment for him. And yeah, that, I wasn't sure about that offside decision. I wrote down very tight. So I was a bit more on the fence than you. But yeah, from the highlights, that seemed like a pretty even match. I had chances right up to the end, right into stoppage time. But yeah, I guess it's a point is good for Yamaguchi when you compare it to what they were doing before. And for Mito, well, they don't really need to worry about anything, do they? Because they're safely ensconced in mid-table. As for Gunma, I think that's a really good point for Gunma against Kyoto. They're a bit of a funny run. They lose one, win one, lose one, draw one, lose one, draw one. So they are picking up some points, which might kind of keep them safe. But that goal, that was an absolute gift for Gunma, wasn't it? Well, I thought it was pretty clever the way he also anticipated that back pass. And he's not, as people have mentioned on the pod before, he's not the most athletic looking of players. And he's not particularly fast, but he did, because he's got the awareness, he anticipated that really well. And that's why he was able to make that pressure on the keeper and allow the keeper to make an idiot of himself by, as you said, slide tackling no one. And again, yeah, Utaka, fantastic strike from him. And that one was really good. But including that, I think Kyoto were mostly shooting from the edge of the area. And apart, there was the one that was headed off the line, but apart from that, they didn't really seem to trouble Gunma's keeper too much. So I think for them, they'll probably be, I guess they'll put it down as a bit of an off day, but they got a point. They're still pretty safely ahead of third place. So yeah, I guess both teams kind of be okay with that result, really.
Yeah, fair enough. I thought that Wakahara incident was a bit like when you press the wrong button on FIFA, you know, and you sort of slide tackle when you mean to shoot or pass. So yeah, I think Omai did really well because he anticipated not only the back pass, but also the Wakahara sort of rashly, trying to tackle him before he actually had the ball. So yeah, really good goal from Gunma's point of view. I can't shake the feeling, James, that Gunma and Ehime, you know, they're down at the bottom of the table so often, aren't they, in J2 every year. You just get the sense that maybe they have like just enough experience that'll maybe get them out of it. I mean, this game, I mean, you can imagine Kitakyushu would have found a way to lose this match somehow. I think Sagamihara would have lost this match. Matsumoto would have been well beaten. So yeah, so you kind of start thinking, what's the difference between these teams, at the bottom? And I think Gunma and Ehime, they just, I could be wrong, and they might get hammered, this weekend coming up. But then, like you said, they win one, lose one, draw one, lose one, draw one. They just are ticking over in a way that makes me think that they might still get out of it. But we'll wait and see. Tied with Gunma on 34 points in the table, James, are Omiya in 15th. Now, they lost 2-1 away at Jeff Chiba the weekend. Omiya let in a pretty soft goal in just the fourth minute here when Daisuke Suzuki poked in Takayuki Funayama's corner at the near post. 4 minutes into the second half, though, it was 1-1. An Omiya corner was only cleared as far as Masato Kojima, and when he lobbed the ball back into the penalty area, Atsushi Kurokawa superbly controlled and swept a shot under Shota Arai in the Jeff goal. There was a controversial moment after that when Kurokawa set up Kanji Okunuki, who made it 2-1 to Omiya, only for the goal to be disallowed for offside. Replays again showed that he almost certainly wasn't. It was an incredibly harsh decision on a tight call. Okunuki nearly scored again later on. His shot was blocked at point-blank range by Arai on the goal line, and the ball actually squirmed out of Arai's grasp, but he recovered and managed to hold on to it. And James, you and I have both supported teams at the bottom of various league tables, so you kind of know what's coming in a game like this. With creeping inevitability, Chiba won it with a goal in the 3rd minute of second half stoppage time. An up and under clearance somehow found Jeff's Tommy Amiki clean through, because he was inside his own half when he started chasing the ball. I think Omiya's backline had just forgotten he was there. He advanced into the penalty area and then beat the Omiya keeper Yuta Minami with a very confident finish. I should also add, he thankfully avoided a potential leg-breaking tackle from behind from the chasing defender. I think it was Keisuke Nishimura who almost would have probably almost killed him if he'd actually made contact with that lunge. So I'm glad that was avoided. But it finished Jeff Chiba 2, Omiya 1. Before I come back to you, James, in 14th place, 5 points clear of the actual relegation zone, it's Tochigi, and they picked up a very handy point at home to the leaders, Iwata. Tochigi actually went in front in the 17th minute in this game at Kanseki Stadium. Their captain, Yasutaka Yanagi, headed in Tepe Yachida's free kick for his 6th goal of a very impressive season in goal-scoring terms. Iwata pressed hard for an equaliser. Yuki Otsu had a shot deflected onto the crossbar, and Tochigi's goalkeeper, Obi, just about kept out a low drive from Hiroki Yamada as well. But Iwata did level things up just before half-time when Yuto Suzuki's delicate right-wing cross was headed in by Kentaro Oi, and it was pretty much all Iwata in the second half, but they just couldn't find a second goal to win it. It was a rare off day for Lukian up front, and it finished Tochigi 1, Iwata 1. James, have I got that about right, do you think? Tochigi 1, Iwata 1, and Jeff Chiba 2, Omiya 1?
Yeah, I think so. I think, it's absolutely gutting for Omiya. Just when they were starting to put together a decent run, they're starting to pull away from the bottom four, that really late goal has sucked them back in, especially having come so close that they almost got the second goal themselves, didn't they? That ball almost squirmed over the line. There wasn't anyone there to give it an extra nudge that it needed. I think, I wrote for that offside call, I wrote another very tight offside call. Very tight. So
I get the feeling you support a team that's often on the end of the wrong end of these fine margin calls. That's the feeling I get.
I'm sitting on the fence. But I think that was it was a bad call. But Omiya not helping themselves. Another early goal conceded. They conceded 2 against Kanazawa last week. Another one here. Their goal was really good, though. It was a lovely pass from Kojima and a really cool finish from Kurokawa. Mawatari's been pretty impressive recently for Omiya as a kind of marauding right back. He got a good goal against Kanazawa last week and that really good free kick a few weeks ago as well. I think something surprising, and I'm going to say something that you may have never heard before, but Jeff are currently the form team in J2. Of course, being Jeff, it's too late for them to actually make anything of their season and they're going to finish mid-table, but still, pretty good. As for Tochigi Iwata, Iwata are kind of just cruising up to J1, aren't they, really, mostly? I only saw the highlights of this and I've seen the stats and it seemed like they completely controlled the game, but they couldn't really finish Tochigi off. And I think that's partly because maybe they were having a bit of an off day and seemed like most of their shots went straight to Obi in the Tochigi goal and he was able to deal with them pretty comfortably. Maybe on another day, if they, their shots had gone slightly to the side, or taking a deflection or something, they would have won 3 or 4-1 or something like that. but that's a really good point for Tochigi, I think. To draw with the team that's top is always a good result, and especially a team that's 12 games unbeaten. And I thought it was interesting that Yanagi, the centre back, he's got 6 goals. He's actually Tochigi's top scorer, which perhaps tells you quite a lot about Tochigi's attack. But yeah, I didn't really have that much to say about that match, because it was just Iwata kind of peppering shots at Obi for most of it.
Yeah, I think in terms of a title race, it's, you know, we're talking about Iwata having an off day when they made it 12 games unbeaten, and they just peppered the other team with fewer shots on target than usual. So yeah, it's becoming, it's not quite processional, is it? But we're kind of getting there. At the very top of the table. And for Tochigi, I think they are probably the worst team to need a goal against when it's 1-1, I think. Because I think they're so kind of, they're such an obdurate opponent, aren't they? And I think they might be, well, the table says they're a slightly better team than Gunma and Ehime, but not to labour the point I was trying to make earlier, but I do think they have that kind of know-how, that will get them a point when other teams might not get one. And again, you know, Kitakyushu in that situation, I think Iwata win that game somehow. Possibly Kanazawa as well. I'm sorry, James. I think Kanazawa would have contrived a way to lose that game. But Tochigi didn't, and I think there are some parallels to the Gunma game, right? The Gunma game's also 1-1. The underdog went in front and got pegged back, and then they just ground out, like you say, a very useful point. I think for Omiya, they do so much right in games that even as a non-Omiya supporter, and just on behalf of Omiya supporting friends, it's frustrating. When they lose games that they shouldn't. But they were on the wrong end of a dodgy refereeing decision, I think, in this match, or dodgy assistant referee's decision. But again, they're just giving themselves too much to do in games, you know, going behind early and then not finishing off their chances when they came, apart from the call that should have been given. And then, just the kind of real, the defending was non-existent at the end there for that winner. So, they're going to have to tighten up there. You know, Omiya, they're 15th, but they're by no means safe. You know, of course, you know, they're only a couple of points away from being back in the drop zone. So, again, we've talked a lot of hot air about this kind of bottom seven or eight teams, but we're still no clearer on who's actually in big trouble. I think we only agree on Matsumoto at the moment. Plenty of exciting rounds and analysis coming up. I suppose a couple of games to round off for us, James, if that's okay. 2 points ahead of Tochigi, and I don't really think they're in any serious danger, but they fit in with our roundup here. Our Akita, they went down 2-0 at home to Machida in driving rain. Machida's opener midway through the first half was an absolutely cracking drive from Kaishu Sano. He crashed in a loose ball from about 20 yards. Just before the hour, Machida doubled their lead with a penalty. Akita's now Eguchi making his first appearance of the season. Just kind of tangled inside the box with Kaina Yoshio. A penalty was given, and Yoshio emphatically scored it himself. I think Eguchi's return, he was actually named as a substitute for this game, but he had to come on early as a sub because Yuji Wakasa got injured. I think this was probably the only bright spot for Akita in this match. They were fairly well beaten by Machida, I think. We had a question on Akita from Martin Spivey. James, what do Akita need to do now to avoid getting sucked into the kind of relegation dogfight? I know, Martin, you asked another good question as well, but you mentioned it's okay for us to save that for a later pod, so I think we will. And before I let you answer, James, the last game from the round 34 slate was what I like to call a phantom playoff match, with Nagasaki and Niigata drawing 1-1 at Transcosmos Stadium. Koji Suzuki put Niigata ahead in this game in the 13th minute. He finished from about 12 yards after Nagasaki defender Yusei Egawa couldn't quite keep out a cross from the left wing. There was drama as well in about the 34th minute when Nagasaki went down to 10 men. Their defender Ryo Shinzato was much too casual as the last man in possession of the ball. He gave the ball away to Koji Suzuki, and then when he brought him down trying to recover the situation, he received a straight red card for his troubles. From the resulting free kick, Daichi Tagami's shot actually clipped the outside of the Nagasaki post, but the home team survived and then did brilliantly to draw level. Midway through the second half, Hiroshi Futami headed home Hijiri Kato's corner to make it 1-1. After that, this game was wide open and very exciting, James. Nagasaki could have won it right at the end of stoppage time, but the Niigata keeper, Koto Abe, he made an absolutely sensational double save from Kaio Cesar, and I think it was Shunya Yoneda on the follow-up. Fantastic stuff. And yeah, we should also mention a sighting of the lesser spotted Victory Barbo. He came on for the last 8 minutes for Nagasaki, and yeah, good to see him back and banging and arguing with the referee at the end. Nagasaki, they're 9 points behind second place Kyoto, with Niigata a further point back. So yeah, it does look like it's just too much of a tall order for them to make up the gap, I think. James, quite a lot to get through there. Nagasaki 1, Niigata 1, and Akita 0, Machida 2. What did you think?
For Akita against Machida, I was able to watch about the first 10 or 15 minutes of this match, and I thought Akita looked fairly comfortable in the opening stages. The injury to Wakaso, I can't remember his name. That was just one of those where two players were trying to kick the ball at the same time, and they ended up clashing legs, and he came off worst. So it was quite unfortunate, but it looked really painful. And so I turned the game off, and then Machida took the lead. So sorry to Martin and the other Akita supporters. Akita struggled to get much going in their attack. They're a bit stodgy, but I think that's kind of their story of their season, really, isn't it? I mean, I think they'll be okay. And you said you think they'll be okay. We've all been saying we think Akita will be okay. But I can understand why Martin is kind of looking back nervously towards relegation, because they're on a bit of a bad run. They've lost three in a row now and winless in five. But so they'd have to go on a run of Kanazawa proportions, while I think six other teams would have to improve drastically to overtake them. So it's easy for me as an outsider to say, don't worry. But I think looking at their fixtures, they've got Niigata next, which is a tough game. But after that, they're playing Kanazawa, Sagamihara and Tochigi, which are all games that are very winnable. And they really, what they need to do now is they need to win those, or at least get points in those. Because after that, they've got to play Kyoto, Kofu, Tokyo Verde and Iwata. So, I mean, if they don't get anything from the next three games, then they should really probably start to worry. But they just got to do what they do best, which is grind out a win and some draws somehow. And they'll be all right.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. I don't think they're quite safe yet, and obviously not mathematically safe, but I do think, yes, a win or even 4 points from those three games that you mentioned after the Niigata game would certainly put them in. I think, who's in 12th? Is it Verdi now in 12th or Okayama? Someone's got 44 points. I think 40... they're safe. I mean, Akita on 39. They're only 5 points, you know, short of that. So a win and draw, you know, in the next couple of games, and I think they can start to relax. What I'd really like to see is, once they're mathematically safe, and I'm going rogue here and I'm kind of answering Martin's other question from Twitter, but I think if they're mathematically safe, I would like to see them have at least one home game with like the handbrake off, just to see how much flair or how many chances that team can create if they are given a little bit more freedom from the kind of rigid sort of 4-4-2, which has served them very well this season. And if I was the coach, I wouldn't be entertaining any ideas of like, what do we need to do differently or change, because it's obviously worked pretty well. I mean, we haven't talked about them in a relegation context since match day one, really. So they've had a great season, but I would love to see them play with some, just let them attack a bit more. I mean, obviously they're not going to turn into Mito overnight. I think one Mito is probably enough for the whole division. But just to see what flair and what kind of chance creating abilities actually in there would be really interesting. Maybe in the last game of the season or something.
That's what I thought. I saw Martin's question. I thought I need a flair player or two, and then an outright goal scorer, someone who can get double figures. And maybe that man is Take. He's been doing all right recently, but he's still quite inexperienced. But that was what I was thinking. But yeah, they're not going to do handbrake off. The other game, yeah, Nagasaki Niigata. I watched this one in full, and it was good. It was a good game. But for two teams that need to keep winning and hope that Kyoto or Iwata slip up repeatedly, this result didn't do them any favours. It was those 8 minutes for Victor Ibaba were his most this season, his longest appearance. Yeah, and what I enjoyed was the most energy he used was to appeal a handball. it's quite
well. He was still going on about that after the game had finished. I think that's what he was deep in conversation with the referee. Like he's not going to change his mind now. He's not going to give the penalty now. You know, after the match.
I thought what was interesting for me was that after they went down to 10 men, Nagasaki didn't really look in any trouble. They were dealing fairly comfortably with Niigata. And the Shinzato, the guy who was sent off, he was having a pretty tough day leading up to that anyway. But that, he said he was a bit too casual. He lost control of the ball. But his tackle there to try and win it back was pretty wild. I mean, he managed to get the top of the other player's calf, which shows you how far away from the ball he was. It wasn't malicious, it was just rubbish. But the fact that Nagasaki were largely untroubled by only having 10 men, I think, is an indictment of Niigata's lack of incisiveness up front, which has been a problem for a while now. And you and Johnny analysed that really well a few weeks ago. They pass it around quite nicely around the back, but then they rely on sort of individual moments of magic to make something happen. And that kind of did happen for their goal. They got a bit of a deflection, which took it nicely to the striker to score, but apart from that, it was more of the same for them. And they, like Ryukyu, but perhaps not to the same extreme, they've had a disappointing second half of the season compared to their start, because they had an amazing start. They were huffing and puffing against Kanazawa a few weeks ago. They are kind of not really doing anything against 10 men here. I don't think that they'll, you know, get rid of their manager, because they are, I mean, fifth is pretty good, but they've got to be disappointed after how well they started.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of food for thought when it comes to Niigata, because I think Nagasaki will be hoping that they can just continue with the form that they've been in from the, you know, at the start of next season, because they had a rough first half, didn't they? And then they've been more like their old selves in the second half of the season. But for Niigata, they're just kind of, it's just not clicking somehow. Yeah. And as an outsider and a casual viewer, I can see that. But I think what's perhaps troubling is that seems to be persisting for a month or more, you know, a couple of months. It's just not really been going great. Yoshieki Takagi, it wasn't realistic to expect him, you know, to maintain his form from kind of February and March all season. Shion Honma has gone off the boil as well. They've struggled a little bit at times, haven't they? And they've looked kind of been too easy to defend against in a lot of games. So we'll see. I it's an interesting point about the manager. I wouldn't rule out a change there. I don't think. To be honest, a lot might hinge on the last 8 games, how they do. Maybe not even results wise, but performance wise, because obviously promotion looks like a tall order at this point. They're 10 points behind with 8 games to go, and they're not really in any kind of chasing form. But I think the front office will be looking at the last 8 games very closely in terms of like performance levels. And especially kind of chance creation as well, like you mentioned, in the games that they've got left. So we'll wait to see. And hopefully we'll see a bit more of Victor Ibaba for Nagasaki as well. before the end of the season. James, brilliant stuff. I think we covered pretty much everything that we needed to from round 34. If it's okay with you, we'll take another just a quick comfort break. When we come back, I'll just pick your brains on the round 35 games coming up this weekend, and then we can wrap things up. So yeah, we'll be back in a moment. Welcome back, everyone. James and I have had another quick break for refreshment. And James, we're going to talk about the round 35 fixtures this weekend's J2 games in a moment. Just before we do, one final question. Mike Innes wanted to pick our brains and asked us, which clubs do we think may be the most impacted by departures from their squads during this winter? So I think Mike's already thinking about the kind of the close season break. Obviously, last year, Kita Kyushu overachieved massively, didn't they? And then their squad was kind of gutted because all their kind of on loan players went back to their parent clubs. What do you think, James? Which clubs could suffer the most from departures this winter?
Well, I was thinking about this, and yeah, Kita Kyushu last year was the example that sprung to mind as a team that's overachieved and relies on loanees. The other teams that tend to suffer are the ones that have a lot of sort of youngish or like mid-20s players who've impressed, and teams that have missed out on promotion but you've done pretty well. So I was thinking maybe Machida and Yamagata, maybe Niigata as well, are going to have a nervous start to their off-season. But I should think there'll be a lot of J1 clubs looking at those squads to see who they can kind of pick off. But what do you think?
Yeah, I think they're really good shouts. I think if we're looking for a team that's overachieved this year, I know this, I'm out of date here because they've obviously just fired the manager because of disappointing results. But I think I might even be borrowing a point from Johnny Nicol, but I think it's Ryukyu who might be losing a lot of players, particularly goalkeepers, because, you know, Junto Taguchi and Inose, who I think was behind Taguchi in the pecking order, but then wasn't because he was good. So I think they will do well to keep hold of both of those and quite a few of their outfield players as well in midfield and up front. So Ren Ikeda is one who I think might get taken away. I also think as well, just I wonder if, I'm not sure if I might be reading too much into Mike's question, but obviously he's of the Omiya persuasion, James. If Omiya do get relegated, or even if they, you know, survive by the skin of their teeth, I wonder if their squad might be in line for a major overhaul. Whether that will be positive or negative, because they might get rid of a lot of kind of big underperforming players or not, we'll have to wait and see. But I would imagine, you know, obviously the goalkeeper that's starting right now, Minami, he's on loan from Yokohama FC. So he might stay permanently or might go back. And I think there's a lot of good young players that the coach, Shimoda, will want to keep. But certain other players, I think, will probably be moving on. You know, Nermin Haskic was one who he didn't like the look of and was out quite quickly. And obviously Iba, I don't know whether he's been injured, but he's not been in the matchday squad at all for the last few rounds. So I think there are a few players who will be on the move. I mean, if they do get relegated, you're not going to see Kazuaki Mawatari at Omiya next season, for example. So I think maybe at the other end of the table, Omiya might be one. Could be turning off their phones collectively for a few months at Christmas time. But we'll wait and see. But I think, yeah, we a point you just made when we were taking a break was there's just so much transfer movement in the J League during the winter, and a lot of players seem to move sideways, don't they, as well. So we will wait and see. On the round 35 fixtures, James, the games are split fairly evenly, aren't they, between Saturday and Sunday this week. So on Saturday, October the 23rd, we have Gunma away at Yamagata, so 16th place visiting 7th. Other games, Kofu host Nagasaki, return of the Phantom Playoffs, Niigata against Akita, we've mentioned already, and yes, the leaders, Iwata, they host 19th place there, Ehime. So I bigged Ehime up earlier, so I hope they don't let me down in that game. But Lukian didn't score last week, so I'm a bit worried about Ehime for that one. I think the standout game for me, though, on Saturday, James, Omiya against Kita Kyushu. So 15th place hosting 20th, but we know that because the teams are packed so tightly together that there's only a couple of points separating them. Do you think that's the big game on Saturday as well?
Yeah, definitely. And especially they both conceded late goals last weekend, so they'll both be perhaps maybe a bit fragile, and also a bit perhaps, you know, they want to not do that again. But it was also, I thought, Kofu and Nagasaki could be interesting because they both need to win to stand any chance of catching Kyoto. So hopefully they'll both go for it, and that'll be fun.
That could be kind of a straight shootout, couldn't it? I think Omiya Kitakyushu is a nailed on 2-2 draw for me. I just can't see any of the result, but we'll wait and see. The rest of the games are on Sunday, October the 24th. So we have Mito hosting Okayama, Tokyo Verdy host Jeff Chiba, and the rest of the games all have a team in the relegation zone or the still in danger zone, James. So Machida host Tochigi. So 14th place Tochigi go to Machida, who are 6th. Kyoto, 2nd place Kyoto host Yamaguchi. Yamaguchi in 17th at the moment. And Matsumoto host Ryukyu. So the 21st place team who are in desperate trouble. They host 8th place Ryukyu, but obviously Ryukyu have got that new manager. Well, relatively new manager, I suppose. The head coach has stepped up, so we'll see what happens there. The game that I have my eye on, though, James, won't surprise you, I don't think, is Sagamihara hosting Kanazawa. So, the bottom side, 22nd place Sagamihara, hosting 18th placed Kanazawa.
This will be interesting because, as we've talked about, Sagamihara's performances have improved massively. In fact, I think these two teams, the fortunes have reversed from when they met earlier in the season, and Kanazawa were still kind of flying relatively high in the table. Had a really good start, and Sagamihara were just rock bottom. And now they're still bottom, but they're not as far away as they were. So this one I'll be watching with trepidation, as I do every Kanazawa match. I also picked out Matsumoto Ryukyu, and what I wrote in my notes was the way Ryukyu are playing, maybe even Matsumoto could get something from this. But I wrote that before the manager changed, so, you know, new manager bounce and all that. And also, just I think Mito Okayama is completely inconsequential, but it could be fun.
Well, I think the way that Okayama are playing at the moment is they do have. I mean, I'm not sure that team knows how to take off the handbrake, but Sata Kyoejo is kind of an outlier. He doesn't have a handbrake, so. It's going to be sort of his sort of long range shooting versus Mito. It's an interesting clash of styles, isn't it? I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting. But I think, as always, it's at this stage, there's so many teams involved in relegation danger. It's kind of hard to pick out where the most exciting action is going to be. I'm sure if we get together again soon and look back on round 35, there'll have been some surprises that we didn't see coming. So. Yeah, James, thanks so much for your analysis and the weekend preview. Hope we can have you back on the pod soon to see how things are going with Kanazawa and everybody else. But thanks for all your insights. It's been great.
Yeah, thanks very much, and thanks for generously calling it analysis. It's been a pleasure.
we've got to upsell people on the thing. Yeah, okay. Comments doesn't sound right. So analysis it is. Yeah. Thanks as always to people who listen and download the pod. We obviously really appreciate that. Otherwise we're talking to nobody. So thanks very much. And if you're a Patreon supporter of the JTalk pod and you help us out and the big pod on Patreon, we really appreciate that too. So thanks very much. But I think from James and I, that's all for now. So we'll leave you alone. But please stay tuned in a moment after some music. Mike Innes, who I've said his name far too many times on this pod already, but he'll be along shortly. He's got the J3 news from the weekend in JTalk Short Corner. So that's all for me and James. But stay tuned. Here comes Mike with JTalk Short Corner.
JTalk Extra Time.
Hello everyone, and welcome to JTalk Short Corner, the mini pod that keeps you up to date with events in J3 of the J-League. I'm your host, Mike Innes, and in this episode I'll be looking back on the weekend games in round 23 and previewing fixtures coming up in round 24 of the J3 season. Before we get started, there's one main item of J3 news since the last pod. Fukushima United have won their appeal against their COVID-19 protocol punishment from the Round 8 game against Vanarale Hachinohe on the 16th of May. The J-League had handed Fukushima a 3-0 forfeit loss for fielding a player who hadn't submitted a negative COVID test. The club argued it was the responsibility of the match commissioner to identify the issue, not that of Fukushima themselves. The successful appeal means the original match results, a 2-0 win for Fukushima, has been reinstated. The 3 points restored and added to their record in the standings, and their punishment has been reduced to a fine of 1.5 million yen, about $13,000 or €11,000. To reiterate, though, a point from a couple of weeks ago that Fukushima have failed to obtain a J2 license for next season, and so successful appeal or no successful appeal are ineligible for promotion. Now on to the action, and there was only one round of 23 game on Saturday the 16th of October, but it further consolidated the position at the top of the table of Roasso Kumamoto, who won at Azul Claro Numazu. As usual these days, Takeshi Oki named an unchanged Roasso side, but his opposite number Masataka Imai made 5 changes to the starting lineup from last week's 5-1 derby defeat to Fujieda Mai FC. Given the contrasting form of the teams, it was no surprise to see Kumamoto take a 13th minute lead through Naohiro Sugiyama's penalty, a rather soft-looking award against Numazu keeper Masataka Nomura for bringing down the visitors' forward Shun Ito. But the advantage lasted only 10 minutes, Kenshiro Suzuki directing a powerful header past Yuya Sato to pull the home side level. Only the 3rd goal Kumamoto have conceded in their last 6 matches. But Roasso went ahead again just before half-time when Toshiki Takahashi was brought down by Tatsuya Anzai, resulting in another penalty kick, converted this time by Takahashi himself. The points were made safe 9 minutes after the restart when the Numazu backline couldn't cope with Kumamoto's strength or speed of thought, leading to Sō Kawahara setting up Yuhi Takemoto for a 25-yard shot that skidded off the wet turf and inside Nomura's right-hand post. Mention should be made of Roasso substitute Wataru Iwashita's sprint and sliding tackle to prevent Junior Takahashi from getting a shot on goal in the 90th minute, indicative of the work rate and quality that have given Kumamoto comfortably the best defensive record in the division. Final score, Numazu 1, Kumamoto 3, a 7th straight win for Roasso, 5 defeats in the last 6 for Azul Claro. Then on Sunday the 17th, Kumamoto's nearest challengers Tagabajaro Miyazaki kept up the pressure with a thrilling victory in the sunshine for their Minami Kyushu derby at home to Kagoshima United. Tagabajaro's reputation for the spectacular gained further ground as early as the 6th minute when Ikuru Aoyama's ball into the area was met by Ryo Watanabe with the sweetest first-time volley, which flew inside the post, leaving keeper Shogo Onishi with no chance. 10 minutes later, Nariyuki Naito's team were at it again as Kagoshima defender Fogechi lost his footing to concede possession 15 yards from goal, and podcast favourite Kaito Umeda promptly lashed the loose ball into the top right-hand corner. Not that the Miyazaki defence is always so effective, as in the 36th minute, no one picked up Rei Yonezawa, whose shot from the edge of the area seemed to go through homekeeper Shunsuke Ueda to pull the score back to 2-1. Early in the second half, Miyazaki almost restored their 2-goal advantage with what would have been a peach, Watanabe setting up Umeda not for a trademark blaster, but a considered chip which Onishi just managed to claw away. The Kagoshima keeper wasn't so lucky in the 67th minute, though, when his centre-back Kotaro Fujiwara deflected Makoto Mimura's low shot over the line for 3-1 in front of the jubilant home fans. 12 minutes from time, the game took another twist as Mimura was caught in possession and the ball came to Fogechi, whose curler to the far post, surely intended as a cross, drifted past Ueda and in. Takuma Sonoda's clever hooked shot in the closing minutes had Ueda scrambling to make the save and keep Kagoshima out, meaning the game ended Miyazaki 3, Kagoshima 2. Five straight wins now for the at times irresistible Tegevajaro, second in the table although lacking the license required for promotion, while Kagoshima are mid-table, having never been able to put together a strong enough run of form. A bit less exciting and a whole lot wetter was Katare Toyama against Kamatamare Sanuki, the crucial moment coming in the 14th minute when a well-worked corner routine led to Toyama captain Makoto Rindo's header being parried by Sanuki keeper Takuya Takahashi, only for Issei Tone to nod it over the line for his first league goal of the season. Kamatamare never really looked like getting an equaliser and the game finished Toyama 1, Sanuki 0. Three wins in a row for Katare, winding up for the last stage of the promotion race without ever quite looking convincing. Four without a goal for struggling Kamatamare. Toyama's nearest challengers for a promotion spot remain Iwate Guruja Morioka, who went to an FC Gifu side for whom coach Takeyoshi Anma made four changes to the team that drew with Sanuki last time out, including the return of Yosuke Kashiwagi and Wataru Hashimoto. Gifu keeper Takuya Matsumoto just managed to keep out a Yusuke Muta header in the 8th minute, but he couldn't repeat the trick midway through the first half when Muta got on the end of Taisuke Nakamura's corner and powered it home. The equaliser also came from a corner kick swung in by Kashiwagi, which hit the bar despite the ineffective attentions of Iwate's young keeper Taishi Brandon Nozawa, and then was scrambled in by big defender Haruki Mitsuda for his first goal since May. After near misses at both ends, Gifu took the lead midway through the second half when Kensei Nakashima floated a long free kick into the area. Nozawa was indecisive and amongst a crowd of players the ball ricocheted off Muta for an own goal. But that advantage lasted only 5 minutes as Megumu Nishida surged down the Guruja left and played in a low cross that flicked off Mitsuda over Matsumoto and in. Final score, Gifu 2, Iwate 2. And Gifu now sit 10 points outside the promotion places with 7 games left to play. Iwate, meanwhile, are 3 points behind 3rd place Toyama. But will coach Yutaka Akita have cause to regret fielding the inexperienced Nozawa in place of Kohei Doi? Fukushima United are still just about in contention for a top two finish after drawing at Vanrani Hachinohe. After Yosuke Kamigata had twice come close to giving the home side the lead, he finally opened the scoring with 15 minutes left, unmarked at the far post after the visiting defence had failed to clear a corner. But with 6 minutes to go and presumably back helping out the defence, Kamigata conceded a penalty awarded for a push on Fukushima midfielder Hiromu Kamada, and Tokachi fired in the spot kick. Hiroki Higuchi almost won it for Fukushima, only to put a stoppage time header just wide of the post, and it ended one apiece. A first point in 4 games for Vanrare, a first away point in nearly 2 months for Fukushima. There was more excitement than we might have bargained for in the remaining 2 fixtures, but then again, they did involve the division's entertainers Fujieda MyFC and rapidly improving YSCC Yokohama, both of whom pulled off come-from-behind away wins. Fujieda managed to go a goal down inside 40 seconds at an AC Nagano Parseiro side that hadn't scored since August, Naoki Sanda converting the rebound after a close-range save by Takuya Sugimoto. But Nagano were ahead for only a minute, their defence caught napping by a long ball from Fujieda left-back Shota Suzuki, which Yuki Oshitani showed composure and precision to clip over homekeeper Kengo Tanaka. And in the 13th minute, Fujieda went in front, a corner by who else but Jun Suzuki being flicked on at the near post by Yudai Iwama. Paseiro's Keita Yoshioka tried to prevent Oshitani from getting a foot on the ball, but in so doing pushed it over the line for an own goal. 10 minutes before half-time, Fujieda made it 3-1, Ryota Iwabuchi dispatching Shohei Kawakami's cross with a flying volley from close range. A measure of the free-flowing football that under Daisuke Sudo has turned Fujieda into one of the most compelling propositions in the division. Even so, in the second half, MyFC had Takuya Sugimoto to thank for two outstanding saves. The first to block on the line a Tsubasa Sano header, the second when Shuto Kamara was through on goal with only the 31-year-old to beat. But the score did indeed remain Nagano 1, Fujieda 3, meaning the teams are both in lower mid-table. At a season's best, 8th in the standings, however, are YSCC following their 2-1 win at Gainare Tottori. YSCC went behind 10 minutes before half-time, a haphazardly organised defensive wall punished by Daichi Ishikawa's accurate, if hardly unstoppable, free kick. Tottori then held the lead until the last 10 minutes when their defender Yusuke Ishida was outmuscled by YSCC captain Kei Munechika as they both went for a Shuntaro Kawabe cross. And in the 89th minute, more defensive weakness gifted YSCC the winner. Substitute Koki Harada somehow misjudging the flight of a parried stop by Gainare keeper Ken Tajiri and allowing Atsushi Kikutani to poke the ball over the line. For those of you keeping score, that's now 4 points from 11 home games for Tottori, while YSCC are unbeaten in 6. The team with a bye in round 23 were FC Imabari. Just to mention before I go on to the league table that the rearranged round 20 game between Hachinohe and Nagano took place in the rain on the evening of Wednesday the 20th of October. Only 315 people were there and unsurprisingly it ended 0-0. Hachinohe's Hayate Tsuta was the busier of the keepers. Both sides were poor in front of goal, and the closest either came to scoring came just before half-time, when Hachinohe midfielder Masanobu Komaki had a shot cleared off the line by Keita Yoshioka, the follow-up by Kazuya Niwa clipping the top of the crossbar. So now to run through the top and bottom of the current league standings. Kumamoto remained first with 45 points from 21 games. Then it's Miyazaki with 43 from 22, Toyama with 41 from 21, and Iwate 38 from 21. At the other end of the table, in 12th spot with 21 points from 22 games are Numazu. Then it's Sanuki with 18 from 22, Tottori with 17 from 22, and Imabari 16 from 21. Just time now to take a quick look ahead to the matches coming up in round 24. There are two games on Saturday the 23rd of October. Fujieda against Iwate has all the makings of a classic, and Kagoshima play host to Numazu. Then on Sunday the 24th, leaders Kumamoto have a good opportunity to pick up 3 more points as they go to third bottom Sanuki. That puts more pressure on Miyazaki and Toyama in their games. Miyazaki make the long trip to Fukushima, Toyama go to Imabari. Elsewhere, Gifu are at home to Nagano and YSCC host Hachinohe. The team with a bye in round 24 are Tottori. With all the week's business seen to then, that's it for this mini-pod. All that remains is for me to say thanks for listening, enjoy your football, and see you next time. Bye for now.